right, I think we are. So we can go ahead and start.
Recording in progress.
Well, I call this meeting to order of the City Council of the City of Atascadero and would ask Councilmember Newsom if she would please lead us in a pledge to the flag.
Please stand if you're able and join us.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo?
Here.
Councilmember Daris?
Here.
Councilmember Newsom?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk?
Here.
Mayor Moreno?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. Well, for those of you attending in person, or whether you are listening online, on KPRL, you're on Zoom, wherever you are, we welcome you tonight. If you are watching on TV or listening and you don't have access to Zoom and you're not here in person and you would like to call in during community forum or public comment for any of the items that's on our agenda this evening, you can use the following phone number. Area code 669-900-6833. Once again, that is 669-900-6833. When you call in, you'll be asked for a meeting ID, and that meeting ID is 889-2347-9018. Again, 889-2347-9018. And if you simply go online to atascadero.org and pull up the council agenda, and it will be on the very first page. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
I'll so move.
I'll second.
I have a motion by Councilmember Borbo and a second by Mayor Pro Tem Funk. We will waive the reading in full of all ordinances appearing on this agenda, and the titles of the ordinances will be read aloud by the city clerk at the first reading after the motion and before the city council votes. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Daris?
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
All right. We are on to part of our meeting that I think a lot of you are here for. We are, after 26 years, saying a fond farewell to City Manager Rochelle Rickard. And I'm going to read a commendation that we have for her, and a few of us will say some words and then look to hear from her as well. Whereas Rochelle Rickard has served the City of Atascadero faithfully as city manager for 10 years, from June 2013 to July 2023. And whereas prior to her decade-long tenure as city manager, Rochelle Rickard served as the city's administrative services director for 16 years, introducing a comprehensive financial plan allowing the city to build financial reserves during economic downturns, and served as project manager for the rehabilitation of Atascadero's historic City Hall, which she completed ahead of schedule and $9 million under budget. Yes, you heard that correctly. Whereas City Manager Rochelle Rickard directed the implementation of significant council directives, such as vital road repairs and infrastructure investments throughout the city, establishing a unified branding, marketing, promotions, and events program to host and support vibrant economic opportunities, streamline processes to enhance economic development and stretch taxpayer dollars, focused on transparency, accountability, and community outreach, and secured much-needed voter approval for funding for police, fire, and other critical city services. And whereas Rochelle Rickard has consistently supported city staff by encouraging, supporting, and investing in them, and thereby ensuring better city services for the entire community. And whereas Rochelle Rickard exemplifies the best qualities of our community, including cooperation, generosity, hard work, willingness to listen, and always lending a helping hand. Now, therefore, be it resolved that we, the City Council of the City of Atascadero, do hereby commend Rochelle Rickard on her 26 years of dedicated service to the City of Atascadero, honor the example she sets for all of us, and wish her all the best in her retirement. not as easy as, well, not that I thought it was going to be easy. So what I'd like to do is, I think a few of us will have some words to say, and I would invite our new city manager, Mr. Lewis, to say a few words on behalf of himself and staff.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of council. It's an honor to speak on behalf of a dear friend and beloved colleague. It's a huge honor and privilege to come into a position when the previous manager was an excellent manager that cared about people, cared about the organization, and ran an incredibly organized and well-managed ship. You know, when we think of Rochelle, I met her 20 years ago and have had a long-standing relationship, and I wanted to share, she has many legacies you're leaving behind, many, many, many. One of them is this building we're sitting in. She was, as you know, instrumental in wrestling FEMA, getting the dollars, keeping track of everything, managing so many people involved, and seeing this beautiful centerpiece of our community rebuilt. Another one of her legacies you may not know is she taught me how not to irritate administrative services directors. You're welcome, Director Rangel. I don't know if I ever really got there, but pretty close. But, you know, Rochelle as a person is kind. She's connected. She connects to people on a level, and I know I'm speaking for the staff and the people who've worked with you, connects to them on a human level that is so important, and you feel so heard and so cared for. You're humble, Rochelle. You've been a humble city manager, putting others before yourself, putting the city's needs before yourself. You're committed. Her family would tell you she'd work all weekend, many, many, many times, and late in the night. And that didn't stop. Unfortunately, it was more than not. So that's why we're wishing you all a wonderful retirement, but so committed to the city's success. Even during the sales tax measure, spending every non-working hour, which is probably 2 hours a day, I'm not sure when you slept, campaigning. And so, you know, just incredible. Rochelle's loyal to people and to this community and to her friends, and she gets results. And so on behalf of the staff, we're so thankful for your mentorship and your leadership and your kindness. And as a resident, how much you've moved our city forward. And I'll just end with professionals. Our first, the public administrator's oath, many of you may know it, the first one recorded is the Athenian oath. And public administrators in Athens would take this oath, basically saying our only charge was to leave the city better than we found it. And no question, you've left the city better than we found it. Congratulations.
Well, council members and our mayor pro tem and myself will make a few comments. So I will start with Council Member Newsom.
I'm going to see if I can do this without being emotional. Rochelle and I have had many emotional calls. She always starts out our weekly meetings with, how are you, first, just to see how I am. Want to say thank you for being a friend, for being a mentor, and being a mother. You have watched me become a mother. And allowed her to play in your office and be a part of your family, as much as you've been a part of my family. So thank you. You will be missed, and we will come visit soon.
Councilmember Darris.
Thank you, Mayor. So much can be said. Jim hit all the best highlights for sure. So many analogies that can be used, and I am going to use one. You, from what I've seen in my tenure and just my observation over the years, is you have definitely kept the ship going in the right direction, on time, and didn't hit any icebergs, okay? So we're all happy about that. I've learned so much from you over the years, the few years that I've been on council, but then even before that on the Planning Commission. We certainly were grateful for your time, your knowledge. I've always been impressed with your knowledge. Anytime I've had a question for you, you almost had an answer immediately. And I wanted to try to stump you a few times, but that's not fair. I don't think I could do it. So you have, you know, tremendous shoes to fill. I think we're successful in that. But you are most definitely going to be missed. You set the bar high. And thank you so much for your service. And 26 years is very impressive. So that's something to be proud of, and we're proud to have had you here. So thank you. Oh, and something that Councilmember Newsom mentioned about how you start your meetings. You always say to me, how is your world? And I love that. Well, your world is about to change, and I hope you enjoy what the future holds for you. So thank you very much.
Councilmember Warpo.
Yeah, thank you. I don't want to repeat all of the things that Jim said and Heather and Mark said, but Jim, you nailed a lot of what I would have said. And you mentioned how hard Rochelle works. And I'm going to reveal something from closed session, which was we interviewed Jim, and then we had the senior staff interview Jim, and then we got together and we're talking. And we were talking about the passion and the energy that Jim will bring. And I mentioned that Rochelle has so much energy. She's a borderline workaholic. And one of the one of the senior staff said, borderline? And so I don't know that people, Jim mentioned it, but I don't know if our average citizen knows how hard Rochelle has worked for this city. And Jim mentioned her humility. You know, Rochelle will be out here, and if it needs to be done, she'll set out more chairs, and she'll take down chairs. And she doesn't look at it as, I'm the city manager, I don't do that stuff. She does whatever is needed, all the time, whatever is needed. And she, just done so much for the community. And Mark talked about, keeping the ship sailing straight and upright. And that's tough because this community is a fairly well-off community, but it's a poor city. We have low revenue sources. And Rochelle has just done amazing things with the revenue that we've had in the past and really set the stage for us, has moved us forward and really set the stage for us to move farther forward. And that Jim is inheriting a great organization and a great team that's reflective of Rochelle's leadership and team building. So just thank you for everything, Rochelle, as well as the personal insights. We talk every week, as you do with all the council members, and it's always a great learning experience for me. And like Mark said, I ask a lot of questions, and you're hard to stump. And I appreciate that because it just shows me you are dedicated to your trade, and you do it well, and you know it well. So thank you for everything, and enjoy retirement.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. So I want to concur in all of the comments that my colleagues have made, and Charles said did a great summary of recognizing the extraordinary financial impact that you've had on this city, and which I have really definitely noticed. So I want to focus on what you've done with the team of this city, because people might not realize that in bureaucracies or any kind of public or private, that there's a tendency for things to go into silos. Usually in most cities, the police department and the fire department don't like each other that much, don't trust each other, and are rivals for that, right? Don't you hear that from your colleagues? In many departments, there's not a recognition. Public works doesn't get credit from anybody. So often our organizations are limited by not recognizing the strengths in other parts of the team. Rochelle has done an extraordinary job of dissolving those barriers and building up a unified team. I'm sure that's something that Jim noticed, in coming in as a city manager. It's certainly something that I noticed coming in as a council member, that the way in which the staff at all levels of this city organization work together means that our community has the benefit of a team that works well together, respects each other, enjoys working together, enjoys serving you. And that happens because Rochelle has made that happen, has supported people, encouraged that culture, and developed it. And then I also want to thank Rochelle, work habits are legendary, for all the time that you have spent with me as, coming as a council member when I was first on that and learning the ropes of being on council. I asked boatloads of questions. I still do. They just questions got more interesting over time. But we really, Rochelle is endlessly patient in working with that. When I took on the role of leading the development of a countywide strategic plan for homelessness, Rochelle was a shadow partner in much of that because I could bounce ideas off of her and get perspective on what would work, what wouldn't work, where there might be challenges. And so she quietly helped shape all kinds of work and I'm sure I'm not the only council member that's relied on her in various ways. But it has just been such a pleasure to work with you. It's something that one can't take for granted as an elected official, and it is such a joy. And it has been fun to see you this week. Look, like every time I see you, you're like 10 pounds lighter and floating another 3 feet off the ground as the load lifts and as you prepare to go in with joy to new adventures. And I wish you every joy and every blessing with much thanks.
First best decision I ever made as a council member was hiring you. that was hard. You suddenly have a city manager give notice, not hey, I'm going to retire in 4 months, but you've got a couple of months finding somebody. And Mayor Pro Tem Funk's point, every single department head put together a letter and signed it and said, you need to hire Rochelle Rickard. And I think as council, we were like, really? Because she's a little quiet, and she's there doing a fantastic job as administrative services director, but hadn't necessarily seen her as city manager. And, a couple of conversations with her and revealed that she was very much the right person to be city manager. And as I say, the best first decision that I got to make. When people come up to me and say, oh, you're doing such a great job, Atascadero, things are going so well, I say, there's a whole team behind that. And Rochelle is a big part of that, because we have to set the policy and the vision, but you need a city manager who's dedicated and committed to carry that out, and Rochelle is. She's done it for 10 years, and there is nothing that you can look at in this city of all the improvements that are going on, the tax measures that are paving roads, that are funding public safety and infrastructure, the new developments coming to town, the restaurants, you name it. Every little bit of that has her fingerprints on it. There's nothing you can see that is going on in this town that hasn't been affected by Rochelle as city manager. And I thank you. I know our entire community thanks you, because they really sense this increasing momentum and excitement we have here in Atascadero. And it required a very strong foundation, and you were the exact right person at the exact right time to help create that. So thank you. And I am going to miss you incredibly and very excited for you. I think you're, as Susan had said, the last week, well, I've noticed the last 2 weeks she's been very, ever since Jim came on board by about, 11 o'clock that morning, Jim, where she was like, we're good, and I'm going to tell you one other thing. When we first hired her, we knew how hard she worked, and that's an understatement. And so we put in the contract that she was required to take 2 consecutive weeks off a year, because we knew that was going to be important. So thank you for everything. Thank you for what you've done for the entire city, for this community. And I know you will continue to be involved and look forward to seeing you more. And if you'd like to say a few words.
I guess thank you is not enough. It has been a true pleasure, a challenge definitely a lot of the time, but a true pleasure serving this community. It's such a blessing to be able to make a difference and see that difference. Sometimes you get caught up so much in the day-to-day that as you're retiring and looking back and going, oh yeah, we did that. Oh yeah, we did that. And I do mean we. This has been an incredible family. This has been an incredible team. Having 5 professional council members that allow us all to row in the same direction and make progress. You talked about the team that we built and the culture that we built. That's what I'm going to miss most, is coming to work, working every day with this incredible family, with the 5 of you, You say, I'm patient to listen. You're patient as I run things and ask questions and make sure that I understand where it is you want this vision to go and how we're going to get there. You guys are amazing. And this team is amazing. I mean, Casey, Phil, Jerry, Nick, and Joe. I got pleasure to work with Joe, Terry, Laura, Luke, everyone. All of finance is here. Lori and I have been working together, 20-some-odd years. Dawn, Rachel, Cindy. I mean, it's just incredible. And it's going to be weird not coming here. I am a borderline workaholic. How's that? I'll admit to that.
I'm thinking so, Marcia Torgerson might have some tips for you and help ease you into transition there.
And so it's going to be interesting not coming to work. But I thank you. Thank you for the opportunities. Thank you for letting me work on this beautiful city hall. This is one of my favorite projects, climbing scaffolding, being up on the top up there, working with the architects and the engineers. F-14 and the progress we've made on roads, the public safety stuff that's been so needed, and just the trust that you guys have put in me. So thank you all. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and we will take a photo together up front. Mm-hmm. and she insists on finishing out the meeting. So. All right, we are going to move on to our consent calendar. Items on the consent calendar are considered to be routine and non-controversial by city staff and can be voted in one motion unless there's a member of council or a member of the public wishing to pull an item. Is there any member of the council wishing to pull an item? Seeing none, any members of the public, and if you are on the webinar and want to do that, you can raise your hand. I do see our city clerk. Yes, Ms. Christensen.
Sorry, but I noticed that the minutes say June 13th, and they're actually June 27th. So I just want to make sure before we make that motion that it's the June 27th.
My agenda says June 27th. So
thank
we won't
you.
Make the motion with that. Okay, I'm not seeing any member of the public. Could I get a motion?
I'll move approval of the consent calendar, including any correction needed to note that the minutes are for June 27th.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Councilmember Bourbeau, a second by Councilmember Darris. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We are on to updates from the city manager, and this will be our first update from City Manager Lewis.
Thank you, Mayor and members of council. Yes, it is, and it's an absolute privilege to be here this evening. First of all, I want to say thank you to everyone who came out for my oath of office and welcoming me home. Words can't express how grateful my family and I were, and I think the energy from the members of the community that were there, just of hope and excitement of the direction the community's headed, was very validating. So thank you so much. I think we're in for a very bright future. Speaking of bright futures, our Fitch rating, this is a financial bond rating, raised from a AA+ to a AAA. That is very exciting that we've been raised on this credit rating for the Community Redevelopment Agency's Atascadero Redevelopment Agency 2004 tax allocation bonds. And according to Fitch, the key rating drivers impacting the rate change are pledged revenue growth, exceptionally strong resiliency, closed lien status due to redevelopment agency dissolution, temperate moderate taxpayer concentration. The rating speaks to the city's thoughtful planning, focus on economic development, good use of the city's resources, and the strength of our finances to keep us moving in the right direction. To put this in perspective, this is the highest rating. This is like your credit score as an individual. And so thanks to the work of the prudence of the council, the leadership of the city manager, executive team, and Director Engel and her team, we have like an 850 credit score. That's pretty cool. So congratulations to us and our community for our financial stewardship. Upcoming, there's always something going on. I'm learning that very quickly. Every week and from now into September, there's something happening right here in Atascadero. Terry Banish, man, how do you do it? So this weekend, join me and my family at Ice Cream Zufari. This is a great way to cool down. Be 100 degrees, so I can't imagine a better place to be at Charles Paddock Zoo on Saturday, July 15th from 5:30 until 8 p.m. at the 20th Annual Ice Cream Zufari. We're excited to offer our new ice cream shop, La Michoacana, located in the Kmart Shopping Center. They'll be serving over 15 flavors to sample. So, I mean, man, among other goodies and sugar-free options, too, if you happen to be one of those folks. So should be a great time at the zoo. Enjoy new businesses, over 300 animals, and one of our beautiful warm summer evenings with more ice cream than you know what to do with. Tickets, this is important, tickets can only be purchased at the zoo the evening of the event. So make sure you're there early, get your ticket. Information for pricing and other details is at visitatascadero.com, and you can click on events. I want to thank you. Our community is very generous, as the council in this room knows. We have some very generous sponsors. Our presenting sponsor, Pure Pediatric Dentistry, they're supporting the sugar-free desserts. Probably supporting sponsors, Barley and Boar. Someone caught that. All right. Barley and Boar Kitchen and Brew House, the Atascadero Rotary Club, Five Star Rain Gutters, and friend sponsor Mechanics Bank. So thank you so much to our generous sponsors. And then we get into our Saturday in the Park concert series, which is rolling. This continues on Saturday, July 22nd, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Atascadero Lake Park Bandstand. Enjoy Riftide, delivering dance music covering a variety of genres from surf, rock, funk, and soul. Now that should appeal to the entire family, a little something for everybody. Bring your low back chair or blanket and bring your wallet for food purchases from our vendors. Make a day of it and get to the park to enjoy the Charles Paddock Zoo, the paddle boats, the Surrey bikes, and Mr. Putter's boathouse, fishing, picnic, or all of the above. What a great way to spend an afternoon at our beautiful lake park. What a gem. And the concerts are free. Escape the heat this weekend. We have a few ideas for you. Plan a trip to our great library. The Atascadero Library is open Tuesdays through Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m. Maybe you can learn something new while you cool down. You can enjoy our Colony Cinemas, a great place to enjoy a movie, cool environment, enjoy your favorite restaurant, or take a drive to the beach. Many of these tips on how to avoid heat-related illness can be found at slocounty.gov/heat-health. And for things to do and event information, you can always go to visitatascadero.com/events. The last thing I'd like to share is I know many of you council members and in our office has been continuing to hear concern about the homeless encampment off of Southbound 101. And I want to assure the council and the community that staff is working to address that as prompt as possible. Cleanup will begin this week, and then as soon as the area is cleaned up, we'll be looking to fence off the area there adjacent to the Chevron station as we repair the grounds. The vegetation and irrigation is in disrepair, and so we'll be looking at how we spruce up that gateway and that corridor and making sure the area is clean and secure. Remember, when we do these things, we always do approach it with compassion and services as we hope to one day have longer-term housing. But we are focused on the area, and I hope that you can assure residents as they contact you, there'll be a prime focus of our staff for the next few weeks to tidy that up. Thank you, Mayor, members of council.
Thank you, City Manager Lewis. Any questions from council? Seeing none, we will move on to community forum. Community forum is the portion of our meeting reserved for persons wishing to address the council on something that is not on our agenda this evening, but over which we have jurisdiction. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes, and we allot up to 30 minutes for community forum. We do ask that you state your name for the record. Makes it easier for us. And let's see, if you're here in person, obviously come forward to the podium. And if you are on the webinar, you can simply go to the bottom of the screen and click the raise hand icon, and we will get to you that way. And I don't believe we have any phone callers at the moment, but if you happen to be listening, you can call that number that I gave earlier and press *9, and we'll be ready to bring you on. Please welcome first speaker.
Good evening, Jeff Hoslin, resident of Atascadero, business owner. And I'm going to talk about Rochelle for a minute. She didn't get off the hook that easy. The good, the bad, and the ugly. She does have one flaw, by the way, which we'll address. She can fix that in retirement, though. So her flaw is she's not a Kwanian. So we can fix that in retirement when you're done settling back in and looking for things to do. But with that being said, you know, the Joy Playground would never have been built if it wasn't for Rochelle. So I will say, from my perspective, for the kids, that is her number one kid-friendly accomplishment for this city, as well as she has definitely kept this city fiscally responsible, which we've always talked about, especially the last 6 to 8 years and where this city's heading. And as a member of the community and a member of the business community, I appreciate very much that your door was always open. You took phone calls. You listened to the community. You made changes as you thought they should be changed. And that doesn't happen very often in very many places. So I hope you have a great retirement, and thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Hi, my name is Richard Moen here in Atascadero. I have a follow-up question to about a month ago. I came before the city council and talked about the signage and the pavement striping for Highway 41 and El Camino. I'm just curious, has the city contacted the Caltrans to come and finish their job and make that a little bit more defined for locals and tourists that come into our town? The second comment that I have to make is I was wondering if we have a sandwich board policy here in Atascadero. I think we need to either enforce it or take it off the books. Government is burdened by laws that they don't that they no longer use. And then the third one that I'd like to mention is our agenda. Now, I brought my glasses tonight, but I've got 3 blank pages here that we could have made it a little bit bigger, so I don't need to use my glasses all the time to read it, but Next time I'll bring a magnifying glass with me so it make it a little bit easier to read. Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Lewis and Ms. Ratchard. Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you, sir. Any other members of the public wishing to speak? All right, I'm not seeing anybody in the Zoom webinar. Last chance to raise your hand for comments. All right, I'll go ahead and close community forum and bring that back to council and staff. We do have a sandwich board policy. It's along with our sign policy that we have. And if, you know, in Atascadero, we don't have the staff to go out like searching for everything that's wrong, nor do we want to be doing that. But certainly, if there are particular issues, and if anyone is noticing, especially a sandwich board, if it's creating an accessibility issue or things like that, we certainly want to know about it. And I know it really depends on capacity and what we're able to do. But if there's anything in particular that you, Mr. Mullen, or anyone else is concerned about when it comes to the sandwich boards, please come talk to us. We did put some out to make sure people know the businesses on Entrada are open while the water company is doing their construction. So those are up. So there are certain uses for those, but accessibility is the main concern with that. Is the agenda, was that the one in the back? Okay, so possibly that's something we could make sure we have something bigger, because I'm not sure most of us could read that. And I'll also have Nick maybe follow up with regards to anything with regards to Caltrans and 41 El Camino. Thank you. Okay. Now let's go ahead and move on to, we have no public hearings this evening. We'll go to our first management report, and that is the draft regional housing and infrastructure plan. And I will look to our Community Development Director, Mr. Phil Dunsmore.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Tonight we're going to be talking a little bit about regional planning. And we're going to start that effort by talking about a collaboration that's commencing with the seven other cities. And it's a look at infrastructure and how that ties into housing production. I'm going to pull up a presentation and here in a moment. I'm also wanting to introduce Russ. He's with REACH, and tonight he's going to be representing SLOCOG and guiding us through this initial presentation to talk about this draft housing and infrastructure plan that's just beginning to be worked on, and we'll get into that. Let me get this presentation on the screen for you just a moment here as I share the presentation. All right, that looks really small.
Yes. Thank you very much, Phil.
All right.
Ready to go?
Thank you, Russ. Go for it. Take it away.
I appreciate it. Mayor Marino and members of the council, I'm privileged to be here today to represent the project team that has been working very diligently on the regional housing and infrastructure strategic plan. This plan effort is led by San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, and the project lead is Sarah Sanders there. She sent a request that she cannot be here tonight, but is very, very passionate about this project, as we all are. And we also, on the project team, include myself, Russ Levenway, Executive Vice President of REACH, and Michael Furt, who is a project manager at REACH, also in attendance and will be speaking with me tonight, as well as Carolyn Berg, who works with REACH under the consulting firm called Cobo Collaborative. Now, so we are here today to briefly present, I hope briefly, an overview of the Regional Housing and Infrastructure Plan, or as we may call it, the HIP. It's easier to remember. So on this next slide, I'm going to cover a few things here. First of all, it will be the background and highlights. It will be the stakeholder engagement, the project overview and key findings, the future faces of the regional strategy, and then we will close with some suggested actions. So if we could go to the third slide at this point. Yeah, I may need to, there we go. The third slide is going to have housing highlights. The point of these housing highlights is to show the tremendous success that Atascadero as a city has already had when it comes to addressing this region's housing challenges. And we wanted to share a few examples which are on this slide, but also I want to point out that the city of Atascadero has come very close to meeting their housing goals in the last RENA cycles. And that is a big testament and actually an exception and an outlier in our region. So something for the city to be very proud of. Among other things Atascadero has accomplished include extensive infill sites and mixed-use projects and commercial zones. These have added density where it makes sense, so it's thoughtful and it's prudent. You have led the county when it comes to making stock plans for ADUs that are available at no charge. You have, in terms of small ABD cottages and community projects, you have one currently in development, which is very thoughtful and kind of unusual. And you're currently drafting a program that will defer the payment of impact fees for low and very low housing units. So I thank the city of Atascadero for that leadership and for that thoughtfulness. And I also understand, as a city, you are working very hard to balance jobs with housing. And that is a fantastic goal. When we see, like, we know that it is a priority for the city of Atascadero to increase the local job. And we see that increasing the housing supply will help meet the needs of those new people that you bring in this community who stay here and work those jobs. So I think that's another win. So housing highlights, all those being said, we do know one thing, and then we'll go to the next slide for that. And it's the fact that there is really no single agency, company, or organization that can solve our region's housing and infrastructure challenges alone. It's just the reality. We have a state, we have building and construction, we have developing and design, we have council of governments, we have accounting and cities, we have planning and permitting processes. So this is not a burden that we can shift to any one organization, whether it's the city of Atascadero or local government in general. But I think we all understand there is a local ecosystem of stakeholders which are really needed to make positive progress on addressing some of the housing challenges we have. And we know we can achieve this together. And that brings us to the regional strategic planning tool and the recommended action for today. If we can go to the next slide, it will show that back in 2019, the city, the counties, and the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, as well as private industry stakeholders, on the next slide, they began working on a regional initiative to strategically work towards solving these challenges of limited housing supply, as well as shortages of infrastructure and resources. So the goal, of course, attract good-paying jobs, address homelessness and supporting people's basic needs, and many other interrelated issues our region faces. And then there were three major goals that were identified, which you can see here: regional collaboration, aligning land use planning, and strategic action plan. So those were the big three. And in 2020, your city council, along with all seven other city councils in our county, and the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors, and the SLOCOG Board of Directors, they unanimously adopted a regional compact. This document formalized the agency's intent to work collaboratively and establish a common regional vision. Big milestones and big things accomplished there. Now, as you can see in this current slide, jumping over to 2022, the housing infrastructure process, which unfortunately stalled during COVID, as many other things did, it was revived. And with the MOU between the County of San Luis Obispo and SLOCOG, under which SLOCOG took over as a project manager of the final effort, which is developing the strategic analysis and the related toolkit. SB2 is a Senate bill that funds this, and it expires in September, so we have had to move at an accelerated pace to make sure the project can be successfully, the first phase of the project, completed in compliance with those bills' funding. So again, what is the HIP and what is the purpose? It's a living planning tool. It focuses the region on ways to accelerate housing development where it makes sense for your region, in alignment with community plans, and keeping in mind the need for jobs, housing balance. That's what it is at the bottom. Now, if we can go to the next slide, we just want to show just how much effort has been put in to really hear the concerns of our communities, our elected leaders, and everybody else in between in this process. And we engage specifically with this key series of groups. And we want to thank you very much, Michelle, for your involvement as a city manager in being and inputting into and providing concrete advice and important feedback. thank you, Jim, as well, because and the city managers group and representing your former city, you've also provided very valuable input. We find that incredibly thoughtful, and it gives us the ability to make sure that this is really something that works well for all cities and the county in the region. We also want to thank our Mayor Marino for her involvement on the steering committee. The steering committee was one of the more strategic thought leaders in the process to help bring it forward. So that input was incredibly valuable. And on the housing action team, I want to thank Phil Dunsmore and Kelly Gleason, who were both intimately involved in shaping some of the message process of this through the stakeholder engagement. So you can see engagement has been across the board and very representative in this city as well as other cities and the county. And we also had other committee involvement as well. And we do want to thank Lorelei Capel as the Economic Development Director, because she has been involved in thoughtfully showing the economic development and jobs and housing needs and how important that is for the city of Atascadero. So thank you again for your input in this process. This next slide here is where we're going to kind of transition here, and you can see this is our schedule. We're making a roadshow right now. So we're at the point where the housing infrastructure plan is pretty well dialed in. The tool set version one, phase one, is dialed in. It's a living document, just to as a reminder. It doesn't mean it's a be-all that ends-all right now, but it's at the point where there's been so much development, it's ready to be surfaced, and we want to make sure that we're on the right track and get sign-off and support to move forward. So you can see we are going through and meeting here July 11th. We're meeting both the San Luis Obispo and Atascadero, and we will meet with every city council and accumulate with the SLOCOG Board of Directors and the County Board of Supervisors. An ultimate role and goal is to adopt this framework as a way of moving forward thoughtfully and constructively to address our region's housing challenges. It's not a binding commitment, but it is a thoughtful process to help move those challenges forward. So from there, what I want to do is turn it over to my colleague, Michael Foote, who's going to take us through some of the really key details of the housing infrastructure plan.
Thank you, Russ. And hello, I'm Michael Foote. I've been working closely with the SLOCOG team on this plan. I wanted to just walk through some of the elements. So if you want to go to the next slide. So this, again, framed as a toolkit. There's a lot of elements on here that we definitely had to push through at a somewhat expedited timeline based on the funding, but really now we're to the point where we have something fleshed out and we can present it to all of the cities and the Board of Supervisors to then again adapt and, based on the feedback we received, implement based on what works best for each individual city. So I'm just gonna go over some of these elements. Not all of them will be in as much detail, but you will see more detail in your staff report and in the draft HIP plan. So really looking again at this as a toolkit that any of these elements can be used for any of the cities to again inform the process or again add some details that did not exist before. For instance, you know, the affordable by design study, there's a lot of elements in there that could go one way or the other, but you know, based on a lot of research that I've done and others on the SLOCOG team, there's not a great way to look at affordable by design for a given region unless you just dive in and really kind of start pulling it apart. So that's really the phase that this this study started. And again, it could lead to some other things, but we'll be going into the details based on what we have right now. Again, just reiterating what Russ said, you know, this is a voluntary process. So some of these elements might resonate more at Atascadero. Some of these elements might resonate more in other cities, but they're being offered up by SLOCOG, you know, to be used, you know, as would benefit each of you. So again, if you want to go to the next slide, I'll start going into some more of the details. And so really SLOCOG focused the analysis on the highest impact accelerate housing supply. And this is, you know, really based on the grant itself, but also based on the need that, you know, we've heard resounding across all of our communities that housing is a challenge and affordability is a challenge. So looking at ways that we can tie infrastructure prioritization to that, directed towards, again, accelerating the housing supply based on a need. So First, we collected community land use data, infrastructure needs, and that support community growth from local cities, county, and key stakeholders. Again, all of this information was provided to us, not necessarily, none of it was made up by SLOCOG, but contributed to the plan based on, you know, requests to those cities. So additional data could be added still. Only including housing project needs and needs that each agency had already identified. That's important. Some of, you know, things might still be in the works. Some elements might still be being fleshed out as those come forward. You know, the plan is a living document, so it will be updated based on that. But SLOCOG then analyzed housing efficient areas, looking at areas that have transportation, water, wastewater capacity based on data that was provided, and then culled down this list of 440 projects down to 80 efficient projects, and then further rank them based on high to medium to low priority. So within those 80 projects, again, really looking at if the project is needed for new housing, if there's a benefit based on the cost of the project, and then barriers to development. If there are major barriers to development for the project, it was lowered on that priority list. But any of the projects that are on this list, again, are definitely the areas of focus. So if you move to the next slide there, the HIP really allows us to then focus in on, you know, again, 80 projects, which, again, you can see some of the breakdown there of water versus transportation. Obviously, water is a higher priority for housing than transportation projects, but being able to look at this data and prioritize is a helpful tool for planners, and again, a helpful tool for SLOCOG and the county to look at things at a broader spectrum, but be able to zero in on priority areas. So really, if the region is focused on high priority projects, looking at that $348 million for the high priority projects, that's 58 of the infrastructure projects. And again, of the total funded projects, that's a very large chunk to again be prioritized as high. Again, this is a tool that offers gives some clarity on a process that maybe wasn't quite as clear before, and then adds some helpful insight for going forward. So definitely can be adapted as projects come forward. It can be adapted as priorities start to shift. But recognizing here that, you know, we want to focus in on housing acceleration, or accelerating housing, sorry, and being able to be really clear and transparent about what our needs are as a region. So moving to the next slide, it's important to recognize again, some of these projects vary from area in our region, and we broke it up in the staff report. You will be able to see the full spreadsheet and can go into much more detail, but just some highlights here. So for North County, looking at things ranging from water treatment facility to, you know, the Del Rio interchange, as well as a charging station. I believe that is in Paso Robles, but, you know, there's a variety of projects, again, based on what each city presented as higher needs and projects that are ready to go. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, there's funding gaps for each of these projects that, you know, we don't currently have funding to accomplish all that we need to accomplish. And so, you know, a major element of this was a funding study. And if you want to move to the next slide. So with that, the SLOCOG basically undertook, or is currently undertaking, hope that wasn't me. We're undertaking a funding study. I might give just a second.
I think it's the actual projector. So our monitors are all working here. We're seeing the image.
Okay.
Folks online are seeing the image.
You know, and I can just run it blind. That's all right.
So,
thanks for the quick pause, though.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. So.
None of us noticed, and if the public can see it and you're okay flying blind, if you've got your notes.
And you all can just imagine real close. Sorry, keep paused. SLOCOG contracted with, and now I'm totally drawing a blank on that. I'm sorry. They contracted with BK Northwest to do a real deep dive into some of what these gaps are. And in that deep dive, really looking at, again, opportunities for additional funding and some deeper analysis of what the gaps are, able to break it up across the region and then for individual cities, and then based on the project and a ranking of feasibility. So, again, a really helpful tool, and if nothing else, can just be reference for your staff that basically some of the legwork has been done already for your staff to, again, both identify the need for these projects and ways to pursue creative funding strategies. More to come on this, that we're still, the final document for this will be ready before August 2nd for the SLOCOG adoption, but at this point, still fleshing out some of that hierarchy and some, again, of the deep feasibility of each of those projects. So more input definitely would be beneficial, but looking at this as, again, a very helpful tool that our region as well as each city can look to say, you know, we have a gap and here are ways to address some of those gaps. Moving to the next slide. And so an affordable by design study was another key component of this. This was a study that was developed per the request of the cities and county planning staff, and really analyzing whether affordable by design is possible without deed restriction or financial assistance in the region. This is, again, a very interesting topic, and I think a lot of us, like I said before, would have liked to see or would like to see more studies on this, and I definitely think this is a great step towards that. So SLOCOG contracted Econ Northwest, and I just realizing as I'm seeing this that I got the previous name wrong, but forgive me on that, to conduct this study. And, you know, their work really did engagement with both the county development and city planning staff, as well as local developers. So really looking at, you know, what developers are saying their challenges are, as well as what planning staff are seeing on the ground. And then taking an outside perspective and saying, you know, this is what works and this is what could work better. So essentially, you know, these findings are sobering but not surprising. Current market for affordable by design rental units are higher density with limited amenities. And then no affordable by design for sale units are feasible across the region. There are some pockets, with the exception of manufactured homes across the region. So, again, looking at ways that, you know, if we're looking to incentivize affordable by design, there are creative ways that we might be able to incentivize some of that. So the consultants are considering some policy levers that local governments and agencies can consider as means of increasing affordable housing, again, without deed restriction or financial assistance. These are, again, levers that are completely optional, and I will say some of them are already being implemented in Atascadero. So, you know, looking at ways that we can learn from each other as well as ways that we can say, you know, here's what's unique to our community is an important component of this, and this tool, again, just offers up some of that information. Next slide, please. So these are some of the levers that are being considered. The several policies being explored under each of these areas, and there's really four major themes in the study. This study simply offers both an analysis to understand affordable by design in our area, as well as, again, a toolkit for policies that each community can consider. There's no requirement to take action, and in fact, you may have already developed some of your ideas around each of these, and that's good. You know, it's just helpful, again, to look at it from an outside perspective and say, you know, this might be worth reconsideration or taking a step further if you're already doing it. With that, I'm going to pass it back to Russ, and he can close it out.
Yes, that's right. Close it out for real. But just again, today, it's just one step, really, in a larger and ongoing regional collaborative. And the effort is to develop an adequate supply of housing and create resilient infrastructure and to support our economic prosperity. And we need, our ask is to have your agency, your community, both private and public sectors collectively to ensure that the housing infrastructure plan succeeds when it's adopted. But as we stated, there is nothing that the housing infrastructure plan mandates that the city of Atascadero do, or specific requirements or a mandate. We understand very well that each community is unique and a piece of the overall ecosystem, and you have to consider what works for your community, as well as how to be a good regional partner in collaboration with the rest of this county. So that being said, we know there's no one size fits all, and as we noted from the beginning, Tascadero is making many positive changes and positive progress, and this is not a new thing, but a long-term trend. So the question really remains is, like, what are the actions at the very end, at this point, that can be taken to move forward? And really, understanding that the whole point of doing this process was to create the toolkit that could allow and enable that. The toolkit is version 1.0 and has key elements, as Michael showed, that create the framework. The data that's under them can be built and evolved and changed over time based on the evolving needs of your city and other cities. But the fact is, the framework was built and it was a strategic plan that was unanimously recognized as a need for our region to address the housing challenges and the fact that, you know, the pain it causes our communities. So with that, my last slide here is a very, you know, it's a very simple ask for, you know, members of the council and Mayor Marino tonight. And we're asking for you to consider supporting the Regional Housing and Infrastructure Plan as a recommitment to the 2020 Regional Compact. Back to you, Phil.
Thank you, Russ. And this time we will open it up to council questions and then we can move to the public comment.
Thank you. So I will look to my council members for questions. Councilmember Borbeau.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I have several questions. I'll start with addressing these to our staff, and you might, you may or may not want to defer some of them to the presenters. The I was concerned, well, I have several concerns that maybe I'll address later, but the numbers of housing units proposed, total proposed dwelling units, shows 722 for Atascadero, which is, you know, not too far from our 800 and some RENA numbers. We're a couple years into the cycle, so maybe they relate. But the other numbers, particularly for San Luis Obispo and Pismo or Paso, are in the thousands. And I wonder, are those don't seem to strike me as being the RENA numbers. So I'm wondering where those numbers came from. And they're very important because they end up being the divide or the denominator, if you will, for the per total investment needed per proposed unit. So can you explain where those proposed unit numbers came from?
First time we saw those numbers was just a couple weeks ago when we first saw this draft report. So we're commenting on those numbers now. They do not appear to be accurate. However, I will say with a caveat, they are short term. They are just this RENA cycle, which is through 2028, which is a short time, about five more years. So basically, I think it came from what we had in the pipeline when they looked at what we had in the development review process. But as it stands now, our numbers are a lot higher than that. Our RENA is higher than that. And our actual anticipated development is much higher than that. So we still need to proof the numbers, several of the numbers throughout this report, and modify those as fit. And we've already had that conversation to do that. So this is, I see this as our initial review, and I see this as a draft document that needs some additional attention.
Right. Okay. Because, you know, as indicated, the total investment needed per proposed unit, then if your number is in the thousands, it brings that number way down, which might make the different projects seem very much higher priority or more efficient or more bang for the buck. And I'm concerned here. I look at this project list of high priority projects and the total number of projects out of the 80 that are considered in inefficient areas, which also strikes me as odd because that means 82% of the projects are in non-housing efficient areas. So it makes me wonder, what the hell are all those projects? Are they just all out in the unincorporated areas? But my question and my concern is how this data will be used. When I see this, my immediate thought is, uh-oh, this is about prioritizing SLOCOG funding. And my concern is that this priority list looks like it was taken page for page from a San Luis Obispo capital projects improvement list. You know, it's got project after project after project, transportation related from San Luis Obispo. and then a significant number from Paso Robles. It's got four total projects from Atascadero, two of which are water-related, okay, which we're going to have to take care of. You know, sewage treatment plant upgrades, the water company has to take care of the PFAS filtering. And it's kind of like, you know, Central Coast Blue down in South County. As much as we wish them success, that's not our concern. And our sewage plant upgrade is not their concern, right? And nor is it going to be in any way, you know, coming out of any SLOCOG regional funding. So I look at this and I see two, well, really only one, Tascadero-related transportation project. And I see 20-some, San Luis, 23 San Luis Obispo high-priority transportation projects. My concern is, how is this data going to be used? We say, okay, there's no obligation on our part or any given city's part to do anything, but how is this data then going to be used? Because these kind of plan or studies have seem to have their way of constantly working themselves back into the conversation in terms of prioritizing SLOCOG funding. And what I see here is just a complete recipe for saying, well, let's just give all the money to SLO and Paso Robles and everybody else can call it a day. And so I'm wondering how this will be utilized to deprioritize SLOCOG funding, because I feel, and I'm deeply concerned about, that's where this is going. So I don't know if anybody can answer that question for me.
I will answer that by saying staff shares your exact concerns. And we do not feel comfortable with the numbers. We know, all as Atascadero residents and staff, that we have multiple broken Highway 101 interchanges that are at a level of service, D or F, that are constraining development today. We know we have a wastewater treatment plant that's at capacity. We know we have multiple areas that are going to receive more housing that are going to be constrained by these resources. We know that we're updating our general plan, and it's going to come up with a very large number of additional housing units, and we have another RENA cycle that we'll be doing in a few years that'll have a significant number of units, and we know we have a lot more commercial development coming and that we will accommodate with our general plan. So we have a lot of pieces missing here that we'd like to fill in. We have a lot of data we need to deliver to this draft report, and I feel like those numbers need to change a lot, and I think we haven't had that substantial input yet, and so I think it's premature at this point to say that the study is final. The concept is good. The idea is good to get an idea of where the needs are, but it's not, I don't think it adequately addresses Atascadero's deficiencies and needs.
Well, it doesn't seem, if I'm reading this correctly, address, it mentions in a few places jobs, housing, and balance. And, you know, that's always a big issue for our community because for years we've built housing. When some others have not, and we need jobs to go with that housing. But it's as if we're kind of changing the formula now. We're going to prioritize housing over economic development, commercial development, in terms of potentially the allocation of funds. And so I'm, again, do you see, though, that that's what this is doing as far as it's going to prioritize housing when it comes to resource allocation over the kind of balanced economic development that we in Atascadero in particular need?
That appears to be what this study does. It does echo a lot of what the state's resources are going towards right now. So I understand that, and I think that's a good question also. I think Michael looks like he's in a position where he wants to speak.
Please do.
I'm not trying to take over, but I can add just a little bit on that, and I would say, yes, to some of those points that, you know, this definitely will be a prioritization, and there already is a prioritization. This adds some clarity to that process. So looking at, you know, if there's a huge list of projects in one jurisdiction and a slightly smaller list on those jurisdiction, what is the criteria that those get ranked against? I think that's an important thing to recognize and to be a part of. And to Phil's point, you know, some of the data has shifted, you know, and just in this timeline, we're now bringing it forward to look at that and, again, adapt it. It's a little hard with something like this to call it a plan when, you know, it's an evergreen document. It's a process. And so, you know, with that, SLOCOG has really undertaken a big endeavor to say that they will continue to update the information based on general plan changes, based on new information. What we're looking at here, what we're asking for today is, you know, really this process is what we're trying to get some unification on. And, you know, with that, it is a very beneficial tool for a city like Atascadero to see, you know, where that ranking comes in and how. And so that's again what this
is. Councilmember Bo, I would suggest that you're on the money. I think that by SLOCOG's own admission, this will be used as a factor in future grant programming cycles. It'll be used as a factor potentially the next arena cycle. Many of us have been around a long time here, and these plans tend to get concrete and float up, and next thing you know, we're bound by some things. And while I had conversations with SLOCOG senior staff today on your behalf with some of these questions and concerns and begged for more time, these plans tend to get real. And so I think, to answer your point, I think it is the intent that this directs dollars and directs programs and focus, and so you should be very concerned as you look at it.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you, Phil.
Councilmember Newsom, followed by Mayor Pro Tem Funk.
So Councilmember Bobo asked a handful of my questions. As we start to look at page 66, the analysis process, it looks like we're missing one of three efficiency factors in there as well. And so as we're looking at this analysis of data, it looks like we are missing a substantial portion that's related to our community. Wanting to know how long it's going to take to update and obtain this information so that we can feel like we have a full picture and have accurate information that relates to our city. You did note, Tate, that one of the projects listed on here said it was North County Charging Facility tied to Atascadero community, but the project location was located in Paso, which was a $110,000 allocation. Again, that's coming off our list, and then it only puts one high priority item at $25,000 related to transit. And so trying to figure out why our community was left out in this analysis or why there's such a large gap, because it looks like our study isn't complete yet. I swear there was a question in there. How long is it going to take to update that information and to fill in that analysis part?
I can't completely speak for SLOCOG on that update. It is something, again, as it's a living document, that was an important component. And again, I know Mayor Morano brought it up several times in the steering committee. Within the scope of this, that was not something that we can incorporate. But I will say, you know, REACH, as a separate organization, not contracted through this, is doing work for that jobs data. And that will be something we will provide to SLOCOG and provide to our region as that data comes forward. So I can say expect some of that data to come in the fall, but how that gets incorporated is a SLOCOG decision. So I don't.
So the time frame of August 2nd and August 8th looks like you're trying to incorporate stuff that's not accurate. I mean, this has a Paso location listed under a Atascadero need.
Any of those infrastructure, and please forgive me if I misspoke on that, any of that infrastructure that's listed there can be changed before August 2nd, before the plan's adopted, and even after. I mean, this is, again, looking to be a living document to say, you know, here is a project and here is how it could be potentially prioritized. So I would say, you know, on the infrastructure side, there's definitely room to do changes, and, you know, as we get this feedback from you, we will be going back to staff and getting updated information, as we're doing again for the other cities. But for those other planned components, specifically the jobs to housing imbalance, that will have to come at a later date, and again, depending on SLOCOG's direction from that.
Were we the only city that was missing efficiency factors in their analysis?
I can't speak for that, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, and I ask my colleagues' patience with me, because I do have on this occasion quite a number of questions, building on the concerns that my colleagues have said. And let me just preface that by saying, you know, at the outset, that I am fully bought into the objective of this plan. This is a vital process to work on housing, and I'm asking a lot of questions tonight and raising concerns because it is vital that this work properly, that it achieve the goals that it sets forth. So first of all, let me just ask, why the rush to get this done by September or finish it up by August?
Yes, sorry if that wasn't in one of the slides, but SB2 funding started this whole process, I believe, in 2017. That's state funding from an Assembly Bill 2. And basically that funding stalled out during COVID and expires in September. So all receipts for the study, all receipts for SLOCOG's time needs to be submitted before September, which again, it doesn't mean that piece of this ends, but the key components of it, the infrastructure, sorry, shouldn't say infrastructure, the structure of it needs to be built out and ready to go by that date. So that's maybe some of the urgency and rush on it. But again, once that's built out and how it's used will be the ongoing piece.
Okay, so the money for the study runs out, right. Expires, but it does not change our ability to get access to some of the funding needed to make these projects happen.
No, we just can't go back through and do another funding feasibility study or an affordable by design study. That has to all get wrapped up.
Okay, good. Well, we'll have
And maybe I should say it can, but someone else would have to pay for it.
Yeah, we'll have some feedback that will maybe help you use the rest of this time well.
Yeah.
So let me start with what Councilmember Bourbeau was focusing on first with that, those numbers. And looking at the numbers of housing units proposed to be built, can you come back at you again? Can you define what that number is supposed to be?
So the proposed or anticipated build out came from each of the cities. So each of the jurisdictions. So the city, the cities, and the county all provided some of those numbers, and that was, I would venture to guess, last fall, and probably either some things have changed or some of that information was not 100% provided. But we have been building out from that and building it in a way that can be adapted once new information changes. So again, maybe even thinking 5 years from now, potentially new numbers will be inputted to this same process. So it's the process that we've built that we're asking really support of.
Okay, so over what time frame are we talking about the building out? Because we have 722 units showing in Atascadero and 6,717 units in San Luis Obispo. Are those for the same time frames?
So first and foremost, looking at a way of prioritizing these projects and then recognizing that these projects won't be built or funded for years, so this is the planning element of that, the structure of that process. So I can't say any one project will be funded at a certain time. It is up to each jurisdiction, but how it's prioritized is what's being reviewed right now.
Right. Okay. So we're prioritizing the projects for funding that might be for the next 20 years worth of funding cycles.
Potentially.
Yes. In this process.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not clear to me that we also have 20 years worth of housing potential from all the jurisdictions, certainly not from ours. Councilmember Bourbeau pointed out that that the net effect of the methodology is that it dumps the vast majority of the money for potentially the next 20 years into two communities of the county. And on the basis of, so I did some deep dive on this, looking at how do we get there? Because the way this works, if the purpose is to align the investment in infrastructure so that it makes more housing happen, so that our community can attract businesses and grow, then we need to look at what that how that's actually getting calculated. And that comes down to the benefit-cost ratio that's showing on Appendix A, which basically has taken a whole set of projects and lined them up, smallest to to highest in terms of the amount of cost it takes to get associated with an additional unit of housing. So bear with me. I have some methodology questions about how we get there, because that's a magic number that's lining everything up and that's governing where the money's going to go, right? That's the whole purpose of focusing the effort.
Sure.
And so we need to understand how that is calculated. First of all, do the units include focus on affordable housing, or do they include every level of housing?
That it was definitely discussed to look at the ranges, but within the scope of this, that wasn't possible. So at this point, it would be any housing that is planned, so the entire spectrum based on how the city is planning that. So some cities might, again, have different numbers, but it is all housing. That okay. is a component that could be updated in the future, built into.
Okay, so at the moment, although the strategic need is for housing that working families can afford so that we can have work and businesses go forward, that that is not where this focus is. This is on everything.
I should maybe caveat that some of the assumption is based on each community has planned for that. You know, Tascadero has planned for growth in that way and provided those numbers. Possibly not completely, but those numbers that are provided from each city will be what informs that process. So each city gets to make those decisions based on what's best for them. So in that same regard, you know, no one city is telling another city which level of affordability they should be building.
Okay, but all cities' projects are being put onto a big list and sorted on the basis of a benefit-cost ratio. And as Councilmember Bourbeau was commenting earlier, the denominator of that number is the total number of housing units for the jurisdiction. So, and that is, am I correct in understanding that that is the number for the entire jurisdiction?
Yes.
If I may, okay. for a moment, I think what Director Dunsmore has said is that we're not finding these numbers to be accurate, so we're going to need to have Reach working with our staff to update these numbers and make sure they're truly reflecting our Atascadero numbers. So I want you to get your questions answered, but diving into where these numbers came from when we know they're not accurate, we need to have staff work to change those.
Staff will work. I will ask staff to work on that. But the methodology by which these numbers are used is critical to the way this project actually works, and why it is that I believe that the way this project is lined up right now, it fails to achieve its goals because of fixable flaws in the methodology. So that's why I asked my colleagues to bear with me here, because we do need to get into the particulars so that you know what we see you need to fix. There are also issues with the source data. And that is something that, as the mayor mentioned, we'll ask our staff to work with. So, but we need to understand, but the way the methodology works is critical to this. So, the projects on this list are all indicated as something that supports new housing. Does this in any way distinguish between projects that are essential to producing housing and projects that are related in some way to new housing that are supportive but not essential?
Yeah, so that is where the high, low, medium within the focus area came in. As you know, there are projects that are beneficial but have maybe a larger community benefit than new housing benefit, and that's where that ranking, that additional ranking came through.
Can you show us on other than that some of the water projects were given higher ranking as a group? Can you show us how that works? Because as I look at Appendix A, what I see is a whole set of projects that are ranked order according to cost-benefit ratio, and then the stuff that was, you know, at the top gets high, and the stuff that is lower in that, you know, has bigger numbers of cost relative to its benefit.
I'm unfortunately not familiar enough to point out a specific, but maybe just a generality to say, like, for instance, a bike path might be beneficial for housing, but not vital for housing, whereas
okay.
water.
And in this, in Appendix Day, there are $45 million of bike path projects that are rated high. And Atascadero's vital sewer expansion is rated medium. The Central Coast Blue Project is rated medium. Why are those projects rated high? It is because of the way the number functions. The number, the way to get a high rating in this system is to have a small number of cost and a big number of benefit. The big number of benefit is being calculated by the entire range of projects in the whole community, irrespective of where that work is located or whether the benefit is systemic or local. So in Atascadero, for instance, I'm looking in Appendix A of the document. So in Atascadero, for example, on page 86 of our packet, you'll see that there's $7 million in interchange improvements at Del Rio. They're clearly related to housing in Del Rio. But that's being divided by all the housing units in Atascadero, as if that project has some impact on the housing that would be happening 7 miles away at Santa Barbara Road. That's how that number is working. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, and I do see your point with this, and I would say this feedback is still... this feedback can still be implemented in this process. There's nothing within the framework of this analysis that couldn't receive input like that to say, be more specific, be more site-specific rather than general. In some areas, maybe general, being general would have been beneficial, and I can see the flip is being raised tonight. And so I would say your feedback is definitely something we'd be considering.
Okay, so
but
part
does not change the core structure of this that is still a way of prioritizing.
Right. So the idea of having a prioritization is valuable, but the way it's being done right now is a disaster. So, but it's a fixable.
Fixable, yes.
Okay, so it's a methodological problem that the scope of the impact of units is not related to the number of the scope of each project. So an intersection improvement in one place, at Johnson Road and Orchid in SLO is, probably has no relationship to what's going on to the housing units that they want to have at Los Osos Valley Road. But those two are being, but it's being divided by the number, which means that a jurisdiction like Grover Beach, they don't stand a chance for any of their big stuff, because anything that takes a bunch of money, they can't have, even if it's a community-wide benefit, they're not going to ever get that many units in the whole Grover Beach because it can't fit them. So
if I could ask you to continue with questions so we can get through
okay.
this. Thank you.
So you've confirmed that it does not include scope of impact in the analysis. To what extent does this, you mentioned at the beginning of the project, or Russ did, that Atascadero has done a better than job than most jurisdictions in achieving our affordable housing numbers and our housing numbers under RENA in the past. And that creates a burden for this community that is on our infrastructure that is reflected both in the intersection strains and in our wastewater treatment plant. To what extent, if any, does this plan reflect the work that this community has already done in the current RENA cycle or in the sixth or the fifth RENA cycles to achieve the housing goals for the region as a whole and the infrastructure we've absorbed as a result?
I would say, at this point, the plan is very much looking forward, and how we look forward is where your input is most valuable, that, recognizing that what Atascadero needs is different than what some of the other communities need, and being able to create a plan that allows both to come to the table and have a conversation about future projects.
Okay. And would it be reasonable for the staff to consider either grouping small projects together consistently in jurisdictions or separating larger projects apart? Because we can make our Atascadero sewer project look great if we just split into four pieces, and then it still gets divided by the same number.
I probably should not speak for SLOCOG to give that like level of direction, but I don't think the intent is to figure out a way to game it. The intent is to say, what is a clearer process in a way that we can together as a region move an issue forward that's vital. So I would say if the challenge is that projects aren't being properly represented, we should address that challenge. And again, it is still tweakable in that regard.
Okay. And is it feasible, would it be considered to have some ranking but to distinguish between the nice-to-haves and the must-haves for housing?
I believe that is a very reasonable thing to request.
Okay. And then coming to the matter that my Councilmember Newsom mentioned about the jobs housing balance. Okay, as I look at the graphic that she was talking about on page 66 of our packets, what it suggests to me in the project prioritization that what will that the way in which the jobs information is will be used is that it will be added an additional priority benefit for new housing projects if they are located in a jobs cluster. Do I understand that correctly?
I don't believe that that detail has been completely vetted. So I would say it is still looking to include, but how it is included and how it adjusts the ranking is still up for feedback and discussion.
So Michael, on Mayor Pro Tem Funk's point, this is what I emailed you about in the very beginning,
right,
about jobs housing balance, and that's how this came into here. But then I said, wait a minute, as my colleague just said, the tendency is to say, okay, now let's locate the housing where the jobs are, and now here's where all the money is going to go. But what we're trying to get across, and we've said this over and over, I've said this over and over throughout the steering committee process, is we have already built that housing and will continue to build housing. But if you're just looking at jobs housing balance in the traditional sense, Atascadero will be left out of that equation.
Right.
And I know I'm getting the head nod, and I've been getting the head nod all along, but that's not reflected in here, and just know that that is a concern for all of us up here.
Right. That's why I'm looking at how this plays out in the stated approach and the stated schematics of this, is that it appears that that's the that the strategy of moving the jobs to where the housing is and to where the housing can more affordably be developed. That's a potentially very cost-effective strategy for aligning jobs and housing in a way that allows our housing to move forward and gets everybody off the 101, or at least takes a few people off the 101. And yet I do not see that reflected in here, and it is important from all of us that you hear that, that that strategy needs to be part of the mix as this goes forward. The question then also, as we move forward, moving into the affordable by design study, what is the impact in this of the study of the analysis, the assessment that affordable by design is not really achievable here in the purchase market and only marginally achievable in the rental market?
Well, I think what you'll see in the report is it goes into detail by sub-region and not as detailed as city, but including the North County as a region, and say here are ways that it is affordable and many ways that we have gone past that just based on the market being so high. So I think it's a helpful study, like I said in the presentation, that this is information that was not available, and a lot of planners have asked for it, and a lot of developers have said it's not possible, and so trying to find why and how is what's detailed in that study. And I would say more to come is certainly a piece of that. So what we're looking to say is this is a tool to use for information, and information again to evaluate why some of those challenges exist. And some of them might be policy levers that we can look at. Some of them might just be it's not feasible to plan and build the way that we wish we could.
Okay. Before we make the conclusion that it's not feasible to plan and do the way we wish we could, particularly with regards to rental market. Let me draw your attention to what's on page 97 of our packet, figure 3 of the study, of the ABD study, where it shows you what are the examples of housing examples that were used to develop this study. And I would note that in the North County, there is one property used for this. And that property is La Plaza. After the meeting is over, I'll be happy to take you over there for a drink, all of you, because this has been tough on you. But also recognize that that is our premium downtown development. It's the bookend of this space with City Hall. It was never envisioned by this council as affordable housing. And you're making decisions about what could be done with three-bedroom affordability in all of North County on the basis of four penthouse-style three-bedroom units that are almost 3,000 square feet apiece in that development. They were intended for Mike Zappas, the developer, to live in, not his landscaper. You know, so this, the consultants who worked on this piece need to go back and get better data on the North County before drawing the kinds of conclusions for this. If I'm understanding how this worked, and I can't speak to the other. The things, and I presume, can you speak to any of the methodology of this piece of the analysis?
Just maybe 2 points. First, I know specifically for La Plaza that they only were looking at the studio, which is the smallest, and the challenge at the time was getting data both from CoStar, which is, you know, a very large data source for real estate, problematic for a community of our size, and data on recently developed projects. So current projects that are focused on affordable by design, focused on, you know, market rate affordable, were difficult to find. So if you have some, please do, you know, provide. But I think that's a piece of the challenge and worth continuing to investigate and to look into.
Okay. Is there the opportunity to get an additional iteration of this portion of the study during the time frame that you have?
That's a piece I can't 100% speak to. My guess would be, you know, some of this is open to future studies, and some of it might be easy to inform and shift. I can't speak to that as a guarantee, though.
Okay, because basing that the set of conclusions that are proposed from this study are not supported by the data that is provided. Because of the choice of the, because La Plaza is an absurd example of affordable housing. Okay, I will reserve the rest of my questions and comments for a little later.
If there are no other council questions, let's take a quick break and then we'll go out to public comment and then come back to council. Have come back from a brief break, and we are ready to go to public comment on this item. So I will look to if there's anyone in the audience here, or if there's anyone online who would like to, on Zoom, who would like to raise their hand and speak, please feel free. I am not seeing anyone. I'm seeing no hands raised, so I will go ahead and close public comment and bring that back. So you've heard a lot of our concerns here tonight, and I think we all support in concept. We signed on to the Regional Housing Compact in 2020, and we think it's important to do this regional work. And so I think we can safely say we support this in concept, but we would ask that you work with our staff on getting, you know, updated data and the methodologies used to make sure that it more accurately represents the needs in Atascadero. You've heard our concerns, too, about the, you know, because we're looking at 2023 forward, we're not doing a back look, and so we have, you know, burdened infrastructure that's not being taken into account because we've embraced housing, you know, for years, and it's not showing in here. We're not, I guess you could say, getting credit for that. And it's not that we want a pat on the back. It's that we need the infrastructure to continue. We see things like our wastewater treatment plant that is most critical for expanding housing, yet there's this other water project that isn't as critical and somehow is a top priority. So those are things that I know you will work with staff on. We've talked about the jobs, housing, all of that. Something else I want to bring up that concerns me. We talk about this being not binding, that it's voluntary, and so all along the way, we've all been saying that. We've all been thinking this is fine. We're talking about how it needs to be fleshed out more, that this is a living document. It can continue to change. My concern is, and I think City Manager Lewis talked about this, and even Council Member Bourbeau, that often these things that are voluntary and, you know, optional suddenly become thresholds for funding at SLOCOG or for RENA numbers or possibly other things. And this was made very clear to me at our last SLOCOG meeting when two of my colleagues on the board asked a question along the lines of, you know, it's nice to have this plan, but how do we hold the city's feet to the fire? That's not what we're looking to do with this. And so if that starts to permeate within SLOCOG or within the county, that is very concerning for us. And I made the comment that I think all of the cities are working well together. Our city managers have a lot of respect for each other. They take this process seriously. They know that each of their councils consider housing to be a priority and how are we all going to work together. But to have that kind of a question of how do we, you know, put some teeth into it isn't the direction that we want to be going. So with those concerns in mind, we can support this I think I'm safe to say, if I'm looking at my colleagues, we can support this in concept and would ask that you work with our staff. Well, Council Member Bourbeau, possibly not. did you have more to say?
If you're finished, Mayor, I don't want to interject.
I was just going to say, I don't see us taking a vote of, you know, hey, we support this, but to have some consensus to say we support this in concept and ask that you work with staff on data and methodologies. But Councilmember Bourbeau.
Yeah, my concern is that, no, I do not support this. My concern is, I'm not, again, going back to this project list. It literally looks like it was lifted from pages from another city's budget or another city's capital projects list. I don't know, because it just puzzles me to not see any projects, any internal transportation projects, let's say not freeway overpasses, but, you know, significant street projects for any of these other cities to speak of, except for two. So, yes, I share some of the concerns that Mayor Pro Tem Funk enunciated regarding your methodology. And, yes, I agree with the mayor. You know, you should go back and work on fixing those and work with our staff on fixing those. But we also have folks and outcomes. We're, you know, I think we all respect the other city managers. We know they're all good, capable, professional people. I think we all respect all the other elected city councils and city council members in our county, but we're all each individual jurisdictions with our own interests and our own responsibilities to our own citizens. And this document, you know, for me, not only does not help Atascadero, it harms Atascadero. It potentially hurts Atascadero and potentially hurts at least three other cities, I think, as well. But I do not find it to be... you know, you can fix some of the methodology, but if this is the outcome, is that you have 26 high priority projects in one city and 21 in another city or something like that versus 0, 1, or 2 in the other cities. It's not a balanced document. That's not a balanced outcome. And we're talking about this being used for the distribution of resources by SLOCOG. And I think SLOCOG needs to know that no, that's a big fat no. It's not a maybe. It's not a fix the methodology. It's a no. And so I want to be very strong and very clear on that, that as this is put together, I certainly cannot support it.
Are there comments from council members? Councilmember Darrows?
No, I agree with everything that's been said. It clearly is not an equally put together document, and it does potentially do more harm for us than good. And I think with the inaccurate data and information that's included in this to come to a conclusion, it certainly needs to be rethought and gone through in much more detail. Yeah, that's all I have.
Councilmember Newsom.
I think the challenges we have is that it seems like you guys weren't prepared with information about our city and our community. It's hard to look at this and say we're missing so many fundamental parts that are important to us, especially if it's going to be funding. I understand a lot of people are wanting us to support it on the basis of there's grant and funding waiting for us, but in that short of a time frame, we're signing off to something that looks like it was created the night before or the week before, and we haven't had time for our staff to feel comfortable. If our staff doesn't feel comfortable with it, then we have to support them in that decision. We all agree that it does need to be fine-tuned. How long that's going to take, you guys don't have an answer to that. You don't know how to address some of the analysis that's blank and to be done in the future. But we can fill it in later. Our needs today need to be addressed inside of this document. So I can understand where Charles is coming from. I can also, Councilman Bobo, and the mayor is coming from, and the fact that we want funding, we know we need it. But with something that looks like this, it's challenging, and I don't think it's accurate. And it makes us look like we're willing to settle and be left out of the full picture. And at this point, I don't feel like we, as a city, want to do that.
Do you have anything further?
Yeah, a few more comments. Because we didn't, I thought somebody else might pick up on the way the wastewater treatment plant project is set up. But again, it's divided so that the part that has to come later is less expensive. And therefore, it rates higher on the cost-benefit ratio, and it's a top priority. Whereas the part that has to come first, the essential piece, is more costly, and so it is lower rated. This is effectively like saying, it's cheaper to build the second story of the house than the first story, so we'll just build the second story. Okay, that doesn't work. So we've got to look at these projects in terms of their elements and have that work. I also think, to the comments of both of my colleagues here that have just commented, that we need to look at whether this achieves its goals and whether it does so efficiently and equitably. Because right now, you've got great goals, it's really important, and the net effect of the data and the methodology is a faceplant. It does not achieve the direction of resources in ways that efficiently and equitably produce the kinds of housing that our region needs. So these are fixable issues, and we've given you a lot to work on, not just me, but my colleagues as well. I support this in concept, but only in concept, and would direct the staff to provide guidance on directing on addressing flaws in methods and source data in this before it goes to the Board of Supervisors. Do it now.
Are you complete?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that will do.
So I think you have a good amount of feedback from us, and so we can tell you that, in concept, it's a good idea. We support the work, but for us to sign on to it, a lot more needs to be done. All right. I'll ask Director Dunsmore, is there anything else that you would need from us or like to say?
Thank you, Mayor. No, I think that's good.
All right. Thank you. Okay, we are moving on to item number C2, I believe. Yes, C2, our development process streamlining, which certainly helps with our housing needs here in the city. So that will be, again, you, Director Dunsmore.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. This is going to be a little discussion about local control. I like to say that by starting out because this is interesting. For years, we've talked about CEQA. We've talked about can we streamline CEQA? What can we do to help the process? Because CEQA is a challenge. Let's just face it. It's one of our biggest challenges that we have in community development. Get that to work. Ah, here we go. Come on. It's coming up. It's coming up. There it goes. All right. My computer's been a bit slow today. So tonight, we're going to introduce you to some ideas about streamlining our local policies so that what we can do is get back more local control. Right now, what we're doing is giving up a lot of local control by not having what we call CEQA thresholds for the California Environmental Quality Act. When we talk about CEQA thresholds, what are they? It means what projects are going to have to go through a CEQA process and what projects can bypass that process. A little background on this. We talked about this in our housing element as a strategy to increase more housing. It also helps us increase more commercial development, helps us look at more development efficiently and have predisposed expectations. Really what that policy did, that program did, is suggested we look at ways to streamline the review process. Second to that, we actually got a grant. We got the Local Early Planning Action Grant, LEAP grant. It was awarded for a number of projects, and one of those projects is this CEQA project. We brought kind of a real early suggestion of that to council a year or two ago. And so here we are with the actual work. And for this work, we've hired MIG as a consultant to help us out. They're drafting these standards. They're working with staff to do that. But we wanted to check in tonight with council just to kind of give you an update of this project and get some guidance before we start finalizing it. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give this over to Kelly, our senior planner, because she's got really some good working knowledge of the nuts and bolts about what we do with these projects, how we carry them through CEQA. I'm just going to describe this one slide here and talk about the two different projects that I touched on earlier. We get projects that can be basically processed with a construction permit or basically processed over the counter. We call those ministerial. So that's a project that doesn't require a hearing. It doesn't require the CEQA analysis, most importantly, and we can simply use our existing policies to do that. Our goal tonight is to get more projects to fit in that ministerial box by having these pre-developed standards that allow us to bypass the CEQA process. The other projects are discretionary, and those all generally require a CEQA determination, and they require us to go through sometimes this full initial study, even some cases a full-on environmental impact report. So here, I'm going to hand it over to Kelly. She's going to talk to you about some of the details and what projects actually fall into that.
Thank you. So currently our code has very minor CEQA triggers to fit into that discretionary box instead of the ministerial box. So one of those is grading on slopes of over 20%, regardless of how much grading you do, how close to the street you are, how nice you are to the slope, if you incorporate retaining walls. If you're grading on slopes of over 20%, you are in a CEQA process based on our code currently. This doesn't allow for a lot of clear standards for applicants and what they need to do if they're building on a hillside. And more projects become subject to CEQA, especially a lot of like our West Side houses. So the topics that we're covering are hillside grading this evening, creekside or wetland development, adjacencies, historic resources, and archaeological resources. So in terms of hillside grading, we have a number of policies and ordinances currently on the books that help sort of give staff some direction but don't provide the total guidance that we are required to do through the CEQA process. So we have our Atascadero Native Tree Ordinance that does give us some guidance on what type of mitigation is required when we remove trees. And we do have a current hillside grading policy that was adopted and ratified by the council some years ago. It does allow for some grading on slopes with a reasonable pad area for a yard if you're grading on slopes of less than 30%, and then doesn't really allow for a yard space if you're on slopes greater than 30% and requires some stem walls and retaining walls to be incorporated into the design. Beyond that, it's pretty vague on what a reasonable area means or what those walls need to look like, if they're 20 feet tall, if they're 30 feet tall, or if they need to be stepped. So we can do some refining on those standards as well to help with people's costs and people's project implementation. And then even with these hillside grading standards, if all of those standards are met, CEQA is still triggered because, again, the only trigger is grading on slopes of over 20%. So there's a couple topics of consideration, and we probably have the longest list in this one because it's one that we see most often. That we are looking to explore for implementing into our newer standards. That is limiting the total amount of grading. This might force some houses to be closer to the street. It might sort of limit where their driveway location goes and allow them to be a little bit more sensitive to the hillside grading. It might have more flexibility for gently sloped sites versus steeply sloped sites, and we can write those kind of standards in. We can also determine appropriate thresholds related to the extent of tree removals. So right now our Atascadero tree ordinance only requires mitigation when trees are removed. But there might be some circumstances where we have a heavily wooded site and we do want to try and preserve a certain percentage of tree cover. We might also develop standards for making sure that any graded slopes are naturalized and they don't look like they're not part of the natural environment over time. And we might explore the use of earthwork quantities as a metric so that for really smaller grading projects, even if your driveway is long, that might be something that we would want to consider as ministerial. We can also look at developing driveway placement and design considerations that do incorporate tree and grading into the design, so the use of retaining walls for driveways or requiring the driveways to use the natural slope as much as possible to traverse a hillside. There are, of course, some fire access standards, some emergency access standards that we are not going, obviously, to diminish or reduce with this, but we can incorporate some features that might reduce the effect on the adjacent trees and slopes. Again, that would include potentially incorporating retaining wall standards or standards for retaining walls in how they look in terms of their color or terracing of retaining walls at a certain height limit. We could also look at establishing consistent ridgeline protection and mitigation standards. So a lot of communities do this that have a very visible ridgeline. I will say that our consultants were actually really impressed driving around Atascadero that a lot of development already respects our hillsides and our ridgelines. There are a couple standards that we could incorporate that most people already do just to make sure that those continue in that way into the future. So that could be a consideration. And then we could set potential clear standards from the distance of adjacent improvements to make sure that people's development on neighboring properties is not negatively affected by new development.
And just to clarify for council, a lot of these things are things we're already doing today. This isn't introducing new standards necessarily. What this is solidifying what we're doing through the CEQA process so we don't have to use the CEQA process to do it. So it would be part of our code. If you follow these processes, you get out of CEQA. If you don't, you go into CEQA, and then we have a little bit different process. So that's kind of like the way to look at this is here's a solution, a kind of a pre-mitigated solution is what I would call
it. Yeah, they wouldn't be requirements for all projects. If you wanted to do something different, there's just a different process for that. So we're just trying to provide a path for streamlining for those who wish to do that. In terms of creekside and wetland adjacent development, the current general plan has a policy that requires a 20-foot setback. Not a lot of flexibility written into that policy. It just says 20 feet, and that's what it is. We also have our local area agency management plan that establishes setbacks for septic, obviously for wastewater and groundwater concerns. And then there's another of other agencies that come into play when we talk about creeks and wetlands that have their own standards and their own mitigations and their own review processes. So that would include the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Army Corps of Engineers, Regional Water Quality Control Board, and sometimes potentially FEMA. And they all overlap and don't overlap in some interesting ways. So we wouldn't be taking away those agency permit processes. We can't. But we would hopefully be providing clear enough guidance where people would not need to do that, or the agencies would be comfortable enough with our standards that their process would become easier as well. So some topics of consideration for this, this area of discussion would be potential development standards for patios, decks, and related items that we might want to allow encroachment for without going through a CEQA process, development standards for structures to encroach without a potential CEQA process, differentiation between major and minor creek drainages. We, if you look at our GIS maps, are peppered with blue line creeks and jurisdictional drainages, and some of them are a dip in the ground, and some of them are like our Atascadero and Boulder creeks that have a little bit more need for some level of protection there. And then we could differentiate based on location or zoning. So we might choose to have some greater allowances without a CEQA process for downtown or some places where we see some benefit to some creekside development. And then, as I mentioned before, adopting standards may reduce or eliminate outside agency review, and we're hoping to get to that point with them. In terms of historic resources, our current code doesn't really provide standards for ministerial approval. If there's a potential impact to a resource, that CEQA process is triggered. We do kind of have an internal policy where if you follow the Secretary of Interior's guidelines for historic properties, whether that be demolition, rehabilitation, or construction elsewhere on the site, then we do allow that to be processed as a ministerial permit. So we're looking to sort of codify that in these standards. And then, as you know, we did recently adopt an ordinance related to the SB9 Senate bill from the state law for urban lot splits and urban dwelling units. And that does allow us a provision to have a little bit more protection for some of our historic properties, but only if we adopt a list of historic properties that that applies to. And so this would be part of that process as well.
And just a quick follow-up on this topic. It's interesting, even if a property is not on a historic list and it could qualify as being historic, what the state law tells us, or CEQA tells us too, is that we still have to treat that property as though it was a listed historic property with the same treatment and consistency with the Secretary of Interior standards. So really, it benefits us to have a list than to not, because they have to be treated the same way, and then we have the other benefits of...
So some topics of consideration, as I mentioned before, just formalizing that process where if you meet the Secretary of Interior standards, that could be a ministerial permit. And I just wanted to reiterate, the Secretary of Interior standards doesn't make you preserve a historic home as it is in its most beautiful form it's ever seen. It does allow for additions, modifications. It even allows for demolition under certain circumstances. And so we would just use that guiding document a little bit more formally so that people are very aware of what those standards are before they come in or purchase a home that might be historic in nature. And then, again, adopting that list of historic resources, we would include colony homes on that list. We would add some significant commercial buildings that may not be listed on the state or federal register, and kind of define the area of significance as that colony era, which is about 1910 to 1926 or so. So in terms of archaeological resources, we don't really have an official map, and we can't really have an official map of archaeological resources. Some of that is protected information. But we do know sort of general areas, and through our CEQA process, the tribes comment on a lot of areas where they have some concerns. Right now, that usually leads to a phase one archaeological study and continued monitoring during construction. So we would be looking to help streamline this process. If you go to the next slide. By potentially eliminating monitoring by just the use of a phase one, and if the phase one saw that something else needed to be done, then that CEQA process might need to be triggered. But if the phase one showed that there were no resources impacted, then they could just move forward with a building permit. We've also heard a lot of concern from the tribes about our native tree canopies and our native tree oaklands. It's one of our most significant resources in the city, and I think a lot of people do respect that resource, so we don't tend to have a lot of issues with that. But the tribes have been concerned about taking out too many trees within an oak woodland area, so those standards could potentially be incorporated into hillside grading, as we had mentioned before. So in terms of next steps, we are, as the last project was, under a little bit of a grant deadline. So we are hoping to come back to you relatively soon with some drafts. We're reviewing some drafts from our consultants now, and they're awaiting input on any concerns or issues or other factors that you see might need to be included. So again, topic areas just up on this slide for discussion purposes: hillside grading, creekside and wetland development, historic resources and archaeological resources. And then we hope to see you back in late September and early October with some code amendments. Of course, the council always has some alternatives. You can direct us not to move forward with this or some of these issues at this time, or you can request additional information that we can bring back before we give our consultants further direction. And we are absolutely available for questions if you have
any. Thank you. Could you move back two slides to the sort of the, there you go. So just for our edification, how did you decide on these particular four areas and the areas of consideration within each of those?
These are the most common issues that pop up in development review. These are the categories that really come up, and these are the categories that are generally addressed in the municipal code and in state law.
And so then the sense that I'm getting is that we're not saying, oh, we're not going to protect the environment in these instances. It seems to me that it's similar to our objective design standards.
Exactly.
That if you meet these criteria, then we can actually streamline this process while still meeting the spirit of CEQA and the environmental review.
Exactly. Yeah, we have our own local thresholds. We have our own adopted local standards. Rather than having nothing out there, and then you've got CEQA or state law guiding it, you know, for every project with a very low bar. What this does, it raises that bar and allows you to do a lot more through the development review process and through these objective design standards or CEQA thresholds, same thing. And then you've got preconceived or, you know, pre-done ideas with the people have a better understanding of what they're getting into. And then we have a higher bar that we can use for the CEQA process. So.
And then again, if you weren't able to meet the standards, if you had a really unique site or you wanted to do something different and unique, that's fine. That just means then we go through a CEQA process at that point and we probably need some additional review.
Okay. Thank you. So I will look to my colleagues for questions. Councilmember Darris, followed by Councilmember Bourbeau.
Thank you. And actually, Phil, I think you kind of just answered my question on the basically taking the standards out of CEQA and using them in our own development standards. The question that I was going to have is there a risk of somebody challenging a project because you didn't use the CEQA process and somehow considering that it wasn't scrutinized to a particular level? I know it seems like you're just taking it out of one document, out of the CEQA document, and putting it in ours, but is there a risk of that where somebody said, well, you know, this is normally under CEQA and you didn't do that, you just did it under your own? I mean, even though it sounds like it's going to be sort of this, you know, scrutinize the same way.
Staff doesn't believe that's the case. Any project's open to challenge, but in this particular scenario, if someone is following our code and they're developing a project with a ministerial process through a construction permit, it leaves very little legal window for challenge. But through the CEQA process, we are wide open for challenge once we enter that process. So that is the way staff sees that issue. So we see it as dramatically reducing the ability to challenge, unless they want to challenge our code for being inconsistent with state law, which is certainly possible, but we don't believe this would open us up to that.
Right, okay, yeah, that's what I was understanding, that you're staying consistent with state law, but without using the CEQA process, and that's where I was thinking, you know, someone through litigation can say, well, you didn't use CEQA, so you didn't scrutinize it properly, but our code, the argument is the code is basically consistent and on the same line as the CEQA process.
Yeah, so ministerial projects are not subject to CEQA. CEQA only applies to discretionary projects.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yes, before I ask these kinds of questions, earlier this evening I said how I rarely stumped Rochelle. But this morning I asked her and Jim, who's a longtime resident, and I've been here 35 years, is where the hell is Boulder Creek?
Oh, it's all the way out on the west side, and it's almost kind of like the headwaters into Graves Creek. It kind of connects over into Graves Creek. It's a little tributary.
So is it coming from the Llano side then, or from the Laurel side, let's say?
Ooh, Llano?
Because Graves Creek goes up there and then kind of turns up into
Luke
El Monte
says
or something.
Llano side. It's the Llano side.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So now I, you know, I was able to teach Rochelle something through another person.
On the 26th year of the final day.
Okay. So on this key question, which I think is your basis for doing this, is right now somebody wants to build, you know, on a slope out on the west side somewhere, and you're having to put them through this portion of the CEQA process. And doing this would save them that trouble. I assume save them some money, but key to you would also save you staff time, correct? And I don't know how much.
Yes,
you could,
yes.
Yeah, all, if you
yes,
can put it in perspective how much staff time one project, let's say, would save you, one house
so
on a slope.
So, for example, what we do is what's called a precise plan, which is an initial study document. It might take staff, how long does it take you to write an initial study, Kelly, a week? Yeah, well, it happens over a week or two, but yeah, it could be 15 hours of staff time on that one document. It's going to cost the applicant several thousand dollars in additional fees, plus a filing fee they have to pay to Fish and Wildlife, and a 20 to 30 day waiting period for that document to circulate. It's a big deal. It's a lot, and this all happens for most any single family house on the west side that really should be exempt if they follow a certain set of grading standards.
I'm almost tempted to ask why haven't we done this sooner, but I really appreciate you guys pursuing this kind of thing because we're constantly in search of this, you know, how do we make our staff processes more efficient for both our own staff and for applicants. And so like Mark said and the mayor alluded to, you're putting this in a standard, therefore you don't have to go through that extra step. Is there anything, though, in terms of now you put this in a standard that would reduce anybody's ability to build out there if they now don't meet the specific standard you establish?
So, again, our intent is to have the standards and then always have a caveat that if you're outside those standards, it just requires a CEQA review process.
Okay.
Now, in some cases, if you want to demolish a creek and build in it, there other agencies are going to have things to say about that, and we're going to have flood control issues. There's going to be issues, and that answer is going to be no. But in general, you can ask for something unique or special.
Right. And then we, in talking about, let's Hillside again, when we talk about removals of trees, reasonable related to the project, I assume that incorporates cost because, I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, you could redesign this whole thing and not cut down any trees, but, you know, you'd have to spend an extra $100,000 or something. So I assume we consider cost as part of the equation of addressing reasonableness?
We do currently, and honestly, it's very a hard argument for staff to say that you need to redesign your site. Sometimes we can say we need to maybe incorporate a couple retaining walls or we need to do this, but it's very hard for us to say, even if they have a 500-foot long driveway, you need to redesign your site because there's a lot of factors that go into reasonable. So creating some clear guidelines, I think, will give staff and applicants and people prior to purchasing a property some very clear ideas of how they need to design their project and make that process much smoother.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're not being extremist in terms of, you know, imposing unreasonable costs on people relative to tree removal. Because, I'm puzzled that a tree is an archaeological resource since, you know, none of them are more than, let's say, 200 years old. And they do grow back. So, okay, and then on the creek side stuff, well, actually, I think that's fairly clear. The historic resources, I'm concerned that, so we don't currently have a list, is what you're saying. We don't have a specific list of properties. We don't generically say that Colony Homes are on our list, if you will.
We don't have a formally adopted list. Staff uses a list. We have it inputted into our system. We know which properties are historic Colony Homes, but there is not a formally adopted list as SB9 requires.
So I was a little confused by Phil's comments, though, regarding if you have a list, then that would allow other properties that aren't on the list to avoid some steps in this process. But then I thought you said that it didn't.
Not sure I said it quite like that. So essentially, we're treating these colony homes today as though they were on a list, treating them exactly the same because state law requires us to do that. So by having a list, it's a lot easier than to say, all right, now you're eligible for the historic building code, which gives you a whole bunch of exceptions. Now it's easy to say, all right, well, we can navigate around that property with SB 9. Now it's easy to say, all right, you might be eligible for benefits in this way or that way. Whereas it's more difficult now to do that when they're not on a list. So they're treated as historic resources either way. But you put them on a list, it's a lot clearer. People know their expectations. People, you know they have a standard to follow from both staff's perspective and from a property owner's perspective.
The thing is, when you say, you know, being on a list gives you some exemptions. So let's say sprinklers are required in all new construction, but maybe if you got a historical thing, you don't have to tear it up and put in sprinklers. Maybe it's that kind of exemption, maybe not. But on the other hand, if you're now on a list, does that mean you got to do certain things that are going to cost you more money, limit what you can do with your house or your property by being on the list?
No. So as a historic property, and I've worked with historic properties for many, many years, with Secretary of Interior standards, their main goal is to keep these properties alive. They want to keep these properties in use, and that means adapting them through time. That means modifying them to accommodate a growing family by doing an addition, an upstairs addition or a back addition, or by maybe saying this house now needs to move. The city's grown up around it, and this property needs to get developed, and we're going to move it somewhere where it's in its original context. Or it might mean, in order to comply with the building code, that person needs to take out all of their windows and do all this work to comply with the building code for energy, whereas, no, I have a historic home. I don't have to do that. I can keep my original windows, and I don't have to comply with the energy code because it's historic. So those are the kind of things that we would typically see on a property that is actually on a list. It's easier to justify that. We don't have to do this research, and especially as staff changes over time, it's not a research project every time we get a development project on something we think may be, original colony home or not. So I think it's much easier to deal with. And we're not talking about adopting a set of comprehensive standards for historic resources. We're simply talking about it, first of all, a very first baby step by acknowledging that these particular properties that were developed during the colony era would qualify as historic resources, and they're on a city's historic resource list. It doesn't mean they can't be modified. It doesn't mean they can't be moved. And in some cases, it doesn't even mean they can't be demolished, because they might have to be demolished because there's no other feasible alternative. And all those things are allowed under the Secretary of Interior standards.
Okay. Thank you. When you bring it back, because each of these here, if we say, yeah, go ahead, you're going to come back with some specific changes for each of these in the code. I just will certainly ask the question or be concerned about any limitations on an existing owner of an existing colony home, who maybe had grand plans to do something. I would want to understand if anything in this process would then tell them, oh, no, you can't do that now.
Because we're already telling them that they can't do that. So we're already having to treat those properties that way.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Okay, that's what I want to understand.
When we make
these kind of changes, are we limiting anybody in the use of their property, and if so, in what ways? So
yeah, it hasn't really, in my time here with the Tascadero, the past 7.5-8 years, that hasn't come up, and we've still treated them the same way. Mm-hmm. And we've moved several colony homes successfully, and we've seen several that have had major additions successfully. We've even seen a couple demolitions. So,
got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And I assure you, good news, only two little yellow stickies on this one. Right. we'll start with the last one. So the fire department has this really great consult program where they'll go out and advise people on how to make their space defensible on these hillside sloped homes. Is the guidance that we're looking to build into this policy consistent not only with the requirements, but also with the recommendations that the fire department is giving people for the best way to manage their properties in a high fire risk environment. Because, you know, the areas that have 30% slope are probably in the woodland interface, fire risk areas.
Fire risk is one of the factors that we have to consider through CEQA. And so as we develop standards for development, those will align with making sure these homes aren't developed in areas that are extremely high risk if they have brush or things like that. So that could be one of those thresholds where a warehouse develops on a site. So it has some interaction with that. I'm not sure that we'll have specific standards in these to that extent because primarily it's associated with hillside grading. But again, some of that will share the same standard, so to speak, and so I think it'll serve the same purpose, although it may not speak directly to wildfire resistance. And a lot of that's already built into the building code, but in terms of location, there might be some of that.
Okay, so as that's developed, I'll be curious as to how well those align. So when this comes back, I expect that question is going to come back again. is there anything in this, if we look at the archaeological resources, anything that diminishes the likelihood of tribes finding and protecting resources that are critically important to them by simplifying the process?
Sure. I think part of our simplifying the process is requiring that phase one in certain identified areas. So through that phase one process, that is generally how tribal resources might be discovered. And so we will still be covered under that. And if anything is found or anything discovered, then that would trigger a CEQA process and some tribal consultation. So the discovery piece and the research and analysis piece of the property at its initial phase is still built into this process.
Okay, great. And then if, as you worked through the kinds of things that come up with the CEQA as we currently do it on the properties, the kinds of properties that you're proposing we change this for, how often does that result in any significant change in the project?
Many of the projects are slightly changed. It's very difficult to dramatically change a project. When a property owner comes in and they already have their plans developed and they paid an engineer to build, to build out their driveway, at least in plan, and they have their dream location on the property with the views at the top of the hill through a thick forest, it's very challenging to change that substantially because, they haven't been given a preconceived set of standards. So they just bring it in and we don't have any standards in our code. And so where we get creative is with, okay, can you tweak this a little bit over here to miss, this significant issue here? Can you reduce the grading by putting a little wall in here? And can you do some of these tweaks? But generally, it has been very challenging to do the big change, which is, hey, can you move the whole house location over 50 feet to avoid that ridge line and to avoid that clump of oak trees and to lessen your grading? That's something that needs to happen in the very beginning as someone's planning out their property. And hopefully they're coming to us and ask a question and we can deliver them with, hey, here's a path to get through the process quickly by a set of standards you can follow. But they still may choose to follow a CEQA process. It's kind of hit and miss. It doesn't have, right now our CEQA process has subtle changes, but not significant changes. Would you say that's accurate?
So we're not losing much in this process, and we're offloading a lot of staff time and a lot of cost for people who want to develop properties.
And when we talk about cost, I think our internal precise plan process is about $2,400 maybe, and then the Fish and Wildlife fee is about up to almost $3,000 that's required through the county. So when somebody comes in on the west side with a single family house, they don't even know that we have this process to go through, and that is an extra cost that they're hit with during the review process after they've applied for the permits.
They come in with a completed set of construction plans. We're working on one like that right now. They come in with their completed set of construction plans, ready to go, thinking they're going to have a permit in 4 or 5 weeks, and suddenly they're hit with a CEQA process and an extra $5,000 or $10,000 and a big timeline, and we have a workload. when we're trying to write a general plan. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to take care of this for quite some time, actually.
Okay. And it sounds like at the end of the day, you know, doing all of that work is not actually changing much. So we're not getting any much benefit for all that time and all that money.
Yeah. Okay. It instead, really what it becomes is a public declaration. And really that's what CEQA is. It's declaring to the community, to the neighborhood, what these potential impacts might be, and we're declaring what mitigations that we can put into the project to the greatest extent feasible based on what their plan is. So CEQA, I mean, really never was intended to dramatically change projects. It was really intended to be more of a notification process about project impacts and project mitigations.
Okay, thank you.
So you said that applicants will often come in with, here's the plans, they've already put all of this together. So how will they know about this streamlined process, or is it something that we're able to apply once they come in?
We hope to get some outreach, and we hope to get this on our website. We hope to get it on social media. Tell your friends. Tell your we'll have to get the
word
out.
Where's Terry?
Exactly. Seriously, we use Terry.
So this will be something that, because I'm guessing that before somebody goes through that time and expense, that they come to the city and they get some information, and so that would be part of that, and we'll need some additional
exactly.
Outreach.
A lot of our local developers, a lot of our local architects and engineers, they do look to our codes and our regulations as they develop their plans, but right now they don't have
most
anything to look
them.
To. Most of them, yes, thank you.
But we have checklists. I mean, if somebody wants to build a house, you don't have a checklist. This is everything you're going to need. You know, site plan, blah, blah, blah. It's a pretty extensive checklist. I mean, this is something that could be in another checklist. This is what
exactly.
You're going to do.
Follow these standards.
And you can avoid CEQA, right. I think that would be a really good thing to have available along with all the other checklists. Right.
How will we go about putting together the list of historical, you know, homes, resources?
We already have that.
I thought we didn't have the
list. We don't have it adopted.
Oh.
So we have it, and in fact, we've had an intern working on going around photographing all of the houses today as they stand to see what condition they're in, to see if they still qualify as those resources. And so we have it all put together in catalog. But years ago, we had a list that was put together by the Historical Society that we've used, and it's, you know, we have it in our local in-house sort of documentation, but it's not put in any city document as a public document. So it's there.
Okay.
We need to clear it up a little bit because it needs to be truth checked. Some of those houses have moved, some of them have been demolished, some of them have changed. So it's a living situation.
Got it. And then lastly, for the archaeological resources, you mentioned in here that you often in contact with the tribes during certain projects, and so is this something that they need to be aware of in terms of, or do they typically understand, like, phase one, that's something that we trust that's taken care of, or what's required there?
We have actually had conversations with the tribes about this project and while we were reviewing other projects with them. And so they are aware, and they're aware that, you know, we would like some of their input on this. We're in an interesting situation on the Central Coast because we have multiple tribes claiming jurisdiction. And so there is a little bit of a feel for need to monitor sites and to have multiple tribal members monitoring sites. But I do think that phase one is what we normally see the tribes ask for through a CEQA document. And so by getting that phase one and having documentation that somebody experienced, went out there and did look for resources and knew what they were looking for, will help them
and that would
be able
to trust.
That,
okay, thank you. All right. With that, what I'd like to do is go out to public comment. I'm not seeing any other questions. So any public comment on this item? I'm not seeing anyone in chambers. Anyone on the on Zoom here who wants to raise the hand? I'm not seeing any. So we'll bring it. We'll close public comment and bring that back. Thank you. Go Phil, essentialism, Kelly, yes, I like it. You are doing exactly the things that this council has said we need to do and streamline things not only for you, but for applicants to make things easier, to make things less expensive. So, yay. And I think that's all. We don't need a motion on this. Are you good with our direction? I think we're all giving you the thumbs up here. All right. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will now move on to council announcements and committee reports. I will go from my right to my left, starting with Councilmember Newsom.
Thank you. I have no meetings this week, but I did want to touch on the Atascadero Historical Society. I got to spend this weekend volunteering laying some bricks in the walkways. So just wanted to tell everybody it's a great way to get involved, support your community, and celebrate any occasion. I have a brick that's in the Rose Garden, so if you want to be a part of history, you too can have your own brick. But it was nice to get out there and, you know, kind of preserve and do the different walkways and spend some time with a bunch of volunteers. Atascadero Colony Museum at gmail.com if you want more information, or you can follow them on the Facebook page. So thanks.
It's a little quieter over the summer, but the Homeless Services Oversight Council continues to meet, as always, and we'll be meeting the full HSOC a week from tomorrow. That's Wednesday the 19th in the afternoon.
Yes, IWMA meets tomorrow. Nothing of great note to pass on. And I would further add that we, you know, after a couple years of turmoil and time of a lot of changes and I think good accomplishment, we may have reached the point of boredom that we aren't going to hold a meeting in August. And that has been a personal goal of mine while I was the board president, that we get back to being an organization that only had to meet every other month. Unfortunately, the last few years have not allowed us to do that. So this would be progress indeed if we are able to cancel the August meeting. Also, I would add that we... the ad hoc committee, of which my part, will be meeting with a representative of the Board of Supervisors to talk through any questions or concerns they might have about their desire to rejoin. So,
way to end the evening. Appreciate that. I haven't had any committee meetings or board meetings since our last council meeting, so I have nothing to report. Thank you.
Yes, and for me, a quiet summer, no committee reports. I have a couple of council announcements. First, I want to say that the council knows I've been working with, along with our with City Manager Rickard, T-1 and counting, I think, on building up our Friends of the Charles Paddock Zoo board. And so we did have another meeting. The board is growing, and there are some things in motion, and so excited to hear about that. Thank you, Councilmember Newsom, for some help on items there. So looking forward to seeing how they build up and move forward and really gain momentum. Secondly, I wanted to let the public and my council know that as part of our council norms, the mayor works with the city manager's office to determine proclamations and certificates of recognition that we will do at city council meetings. And during my time as mayor, there are some proclamations that I have declined to do. There are others that we have attempted to streamline and make much easier and save time. But now, as we have transitioned in the city manager's office, we have several staffing vacancies in the spirit of essentialism and getting back to the business of governance. The city will no longer be doing proclamations except for those specifically related to city business. So, for example, Fire Prevention Week, public works, parks, things like that. In accordance with our norms, any council member is welcome to write letters of recognition, and that will, of course, remain unchanged. And with that, I will ask if there are any individual determinations.
I did have two things. One, I wanted to make a comment. I recently attended a League of Cities meeting as the chair of the Revenue and Taxation Committee, and I could hardly walk into a room without at least a couple people telling me how lucky we are to have Jim Lewis as our new city manager. So, as you know, Jim is very active in the League of Cities, and I don't know what he does. He must be a great schmoozer because they all they all seem to love him. So, Jim, you got a lot of fans out there in the League of Cities. The other thing I was going to mention was, I think, more unfortunate, is I got a call from somebody with the Beaver Brigade. And, of course, if you haven't taken the tour to go see the beaver dams in the Salinas River, some of them near our water treatment plant, it's a great tour. It's an interesting thing. But, there's been some deliberate destruction of the beaver dams by ATV riders. And we may hear from the Beaver Brigade on that a little bit at our August meeting. They might intend to come and speak. I don't know that there's, you know, what we as a city could do, but if there's anything we can do, it might be interesting to hear from them and their ideas. But it's very unfortunate to hear about kind of malicious individuals that would do that to a beaver dam. So anyway, that's it. Thank you. Thank
you. Any other individual determinations?
I'll just note briefly, we'll see it in the reports, I'm going to be joining the August meeting remotely due to family business.
Thank you. And seeing no others, yes, welcome, Jim. It's been a nice week and a half, and as Councilmember Bourbeau said, many of the comments I've gotten throughout the county have been very positive and how lucky we are, and especially from your previous mayor, who is a friend of mine, and he has nothing but wonderful things to say about you and wishing us all well with you. So onward and upward, and a final farewell to City Manager Rickard. Meeting adjourned.